hello, good afternoon, Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM for another Thursday afternoon. My name is Scotty Hertz, once again broadcasting from the super most secretive of secret locations in town, but still a secret, and I am joined, as usual, by Chief Assignment Editor and Guelph Politico, Adam A. Donaldson, who is on the Skype line right now. Adam, how are you?
I'm here.
Excellent. How are you today?
I'm good. I was worried there for a minute. I was about tech things, but it seems to be working good now.
Oh, no worries. No worries. It'll be okay. I assure you. It may be a secret location, but the kit is still pretty, you know, up to date. Well, almost. Anyway, today on the show, we will be covering several topics. Closer to the bottom of the show, we'll be talking about the long-term care crisis and the COVID crisis in general in Ontario, in Canada, and in the world, and where we stand on that these days. And racism, is it just an American question or a Canadian question as well, or is it a question for all of us, and once again covering the entire planet question? Of course it is, but we'll get to that at the bottom of the second half. But off the top, and probably for the majority of the first half of the show, we will be talking about the, let's just call it the situation in the United States. I had riot, rebellion, revolution. It hasn't quite come to that yet. Maybe some of those things, but not all of those things. But of course, as we know, with the death last week, and it's just like, it feels like this has been, well, it has been going on for a long time, but this particular stream of events is day 8 or 9. And George Floyd's funeral was today, I believe. And for those of you who don't know, but I'm positive that the majority of our listeners know, George Floyd was a person killed by police in Minneapolis just last week. And we have seen so much happen within a week and a bit and ongoing. So, Adam, as you know, I'm not really near media during the day. Have there been any developments today that are noteworthy, other than I think George Floyd's funeral was today, is that correct?
Well, there are a series of memorials and remembrances for George Floyd. Yeah, the main one was today. It was in Minneapolis. Reverend Al Sharpton gave the eulogy. It attracted people from all over town, and it was a big celebration of life. There is I think there's some kind of memorial or remembrance this weekend in Atlanta where he spent some time, and in Houston, where I believe George Floyd was born in Houston. And then that's next Tuesday. And that kind of marks the end of the official period of mourning, which I'm sure Mr. Floyd would have had no idea the outpouring of love and remembrance that his life and unfortunately his death have had. It's become almost pope-like, the the series of remembrances that have happened around his untimely death.
Yes, and of course he has become, well, let's say a flashpoint. And of course, as I said before, we've talked about this on and off over the years. I was thinking back to 2016 in particular, which was the beginnings of, or at least the solidification of the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. And it's not difficult for us to talk about this because we are media people, but I wanted to make clear off the top before we got into this any further too, is that people, I mean, we have this show and we sort of jest that, okay, it's the two white guys and they're going to talk about black issues for a half an hour. And actually I went back into our archive and I couldn't find it. I think it's the chunk of the archive that, was damaged. The first or second guest was Desmond Cole. And I reached out to him, but as you've probably heard, he's very much in demand. This would have been about 5 years ago when we had him on the show, but it was just before he became a bit more of a known with his article in Toronto Life and a point person on this. And I would say that people should seek out the point people on this, and both Canadian and American, but particularly in America, there are lots of voices. I overheard a bit of Democracy Now!, which is on CFRU at 11 AM every day, Monday to Friday, and Amy Goodman in the epicenter of the pandemic, as she says, also the epicenter of everything that's going on, everything else that's going on in the U.S., has had some excellent guests, including who was it this week? Did you happen to hear that show, Adam? Or
no, I don't tune into Democracy Now.
It's probably the only thing I can tune into during the day, but it's also in our archive as well. This is me sort of doing a plug for another show, but Cornel West is a regular guest. Angela Davis, Kianga Yamada Taylor, who's an academic out of the U.S., has always excellent to hear from those people rather than just the two white dudes that have the show on CFRU on a Thursday afternoon. So I just wanted to say that before we got right into the weeds, because it's very easy to get into the weeds, especially from the political angle or angles. Weird that you mentioned the Pope there. Did you see the Trump making that visit to the shrine? Do you know there's a shrine to John Paul in Washington?
It was kind of hard to miss. John Paul II has a sort of grander political significance because he was the Pope at the end of the Cold War, and he's one of the figures that's kind of credited with ending the Cold War because he was Polish. Poland was kind of one of the first dominoes in the Iron Curtain to fall because there was a big Union uprising in 82 or 83 that was sort of outside the communist control, and a lot of that was sort of tied to his election as Pope a few years before that, and so he's kind of more transformational than just merely being a pope. He does have that sort of grander political significance too.
Yes,
why Trump wanted to go there and make an occasion of it is another question entirely.
Well, I think it definitely ties into the, let's call it the Bible incident, for lack of a better a word, the Bible prop. Trump has taken a lot of flack from not just the faith community, but other Republicans, some governors in particular. This is the governor, or Republicans, governors and otherwise, and the only black Republican senator, I can't remember his name, have kind of gone off message, because normally they all just sort of bow to Trump. But in this instance, they're like, okay, you had, it sounds like William Barr arranged the tear gassing of everybody that had gathered, I guess it's Pennsylvania out there, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
Flashbang grenades, clear the decks. Then Trump emerges in this weird walk to the to a small church that's across from the White House and holds up a Bible that was pointed out incorrectly and does this. And the media, whoever was gathered there, was said, well, is that your Bible? He said, it is a Bible. Really playing to the base, right? And some of the base were like, this is great. But the actual bishop of the church said that she thought it was disgraceful. I'm paraphrasing, but she was like, how dare you use my church, this church, and the Bible as so blatant a prop in the face of everything else that's going on? Just incredible, incredible stuff.
A lot of people, first of all, the Bible was a prop that was brought over to the church in Ivanka Trump's $1,500 handbag. So that should tell you just about everything there. But I mean,
did she have her I don't care, do you coat on, whatever the heck that was? Yeah, probably.
No,
right.
But she was one of the few people in that entourage that was wearing a surgical mask. So good on her. The whole thing with the Bible, it speaks to just how much Christianity has become a part of identity politics. And it's weird because the people who complain loudest about identity politics are the people who are very pro-Trump, very Republican, pro-police, anti-demonstrators, anti-Antifa, all that stuff. And here you have Donald Trump literally using the Bible as a prop. He's literally using a church as a prop. He doesn't go to the church. He doesn't go inside the church. He doesn't kneel in prayer. He doesn't recite a moment of scripture. Not that I would have expected him to do any of those things.
Because he doesn't know any. There's that famous bit where they ask, well, what's your favorite Bible verse? And
he says that's
all the testaments.
Like they asked him to see his latest colon cancer screening. It was silly, but I mean, it worked. It worked on some of like the key people that he needs to, you know, keep in his good graces. Like the morning after, I saw Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, who's long been seen as one of the sort of the thinking people of like the Tea Party slash Trump era, saying, like, now that's what a president does. And I was reading that tweet and I was like, a president does what? I don't I didn't understand the significance. I mean, also the stunt wasn't directed at people like me anyway. Tim Scott is also the name of that Republican senator, by the way.
Yes. Yes.
His name is Tim Scott.
So Trump playing to the base, of course, and that I'm going to say the base meter, but that what measures that vote or that section of appreciation goes up. Also, when he does things like evoke the Insurrection Act, which is an ancient, and when I say ancient, in the scheme of America, it is old, like a 200-year-old act.
It's like the Magna Carta of American like legislation.
And supposedly it's never been used on protesters before. It has been used in some situations, but not anything like this. Because he's, what did he say? I'm your law and order president. I will back anybody who protests peacefully. But you Antifa looters and anarchists, and like he's just saying stuff. The Antifa comment, quite amazing because.
Right.
And once again, The Onion is like, Antifa realizes that they're a movement or something. Like, it's more of a, Antifa is a concept. You can't obviously arrest a concept. But
I mean, there are groups that are called, like, Antifa. But, I mean, there's no, like, kind of no central structure for Antifa. It's very loose. I mean, it's not like the Tea Party where there was, you know, you had groups using Tea Party brand. I mean, a lot of that was also organized by outside forces, you know, Americans for Prosperity or whatever it's called, you know, did a lot of that Tea Party organizing. But, you know, Antifa is so much more loose than that. And it's one of, like, sort of the key misunderstandings when you have, like, people like Marco Rubio come out and go, like, this is your Antifa. And there was a thing, speaking of news today, Project Veritas, which is this quote-unquote group that pursues the truth. They famously fudged a video of abortion providers bragging about harvesting organs from fetuses, put out a thing they put out a thing today that said Antifa was secretly organizing in this feminist bookstore in Seattle that's been closed for 2 years. And I mean, and then, you know, Marco Rubio of all people retweets that and is like, here's the proof that Antifa is organizing. And I was like, first of all, it's not proof. Second of all, there's no Antifa organization, and you just don't fundamentally understand things. And the things, like, we're talking about, too, the things about Trump, in so much as it's important to recognize the things that the president of the United States says and does, he's almost a non-entity in all this because nothing he says matters. Nothing he says comes from a place of knowledge or experience or even, like, discussion. Like, he's not, like, gathering people together for a discussion and learning from them. He's just blowing things out of his mouth and just, you know, trying his best to get to the end of the news cycle, which is, of course, what that stunt in front of the church was. It was him trying to get to the end of the news cycle by showing what he thinks is strength. And he won that news day. He won the Monday news day. He got to Tuesday, and that was all he cared about.
Yeah, and also trying to get to the next election cycle as well.
Oh, yeah.
But that's,
oh, yeah.
It's all about that as well. In Trump's eyes, anyway. Now, there was people seem surprised that there's a bunker in the White House, but it sounds like the bunker was occupied for a period of time over the weekend. Anybody who's watched House of Cards knows there's a bunker in the White House. I'm sure it's made an appearance on other shows. I believe that's where they heard about the takedown of Osama bin Laden. But anyway, White House goes all dark, completely dark for the first time in a very long time by the sounds of it, if ever. There was a contrasting photo put up of the Obama White House in a June when it was the Obama White House and it was done up in the rainbow colors. And now we are in 2020 and the White House is all dark, and it wasn't because they were in mourning. A significant development this week in terms of the police in question, the George Floyd murder, alleged murder, we still have to say, that the charges on the main suspect up to murder 2 from murder 3, which only exists in Minnesota and certain states. So murder 2 is, or second degree murder, as we call it, is malice oriented, but it wasn't pre-planned. And the other three were, what were the other three charged with, Adam?
They were accessories to second-degree murder.
So, which is fairly clear from the video that they're just kind of standing there. You can see why that is the case. Now, do you think, is it possible that that is what has brought down the level of anger, let's say, at the protest? There's obviously still massive numbers of people out, especially in Washington. They implemented curfews in a lot of places in the U.S., which were, I believe they were ignored in Washington, but there was no troops arrived, and then troops were told to leave. And I want to say Minister of Defense, but that's Canadian. Defense Secretary Mark Esper also kind of contradicting Trump, saying that he was not for the use of soldiers on U.S. citizens. And speaking out like that tends to get people fired. I saw a little bit. I wasn't sure what I was seeing, whether it was fake news or not, this afternoon that Trump had actually fired him. But did you hear anything about that at all today? Or
I heard he got chewed out in the Oval.
Yeah, you can see that. I mean, that's a given. You're going to risk that. It sounds like everybody eventually gets chewed out by Trump. But
well, what we're seeing here with like people like Esper and like Jim Mattis famously issued a statement last night that was very, very critical of Trump. You know, even Ivanka Trump this week quoting Bible verses and putting up pride flags on her Twitter feed.
Did she really? Wow, that's surprising.
Yeah, I mean, you see these people basically trying to salvage their reputations. I really think Ivanka Trump's of the opinion that once this ride is over, she's going to be able to waltz back into New York society. And heck, maybe she will. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein was able to waltz back into New York society after he got out of prison.
Yikes!
But can you tell I watched that miniseries on Netflix last weekend?
Yes. I did. I haven't seen it yet, but I mean, who knows? It's on the longer list, let's call it. But yeah.
But I mean, I don't think this is purely about George Floyd. He was like certainly the flashpoint, but I mean, there has been like an escalation of these things, right? In the last few weeks, you had Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, a young man.
He was assassinated pretty much while jogging.
Yeah. A former law enforcement officer and his son basically chased them down in his truck and shot him in the street. You have Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, who police were executing a search warrant on her residence with her partner anyway, at 1 o'clock in the morning after they had already taken the person they were looking for in custody. It's alleged that her partner fired at the police. He says that the police did not announce themselves, so he thought he was shooting at an intruder, but the police fired back, and she was killed. She was struck with 8 bullets. As the police were at least issuing a no-knock warrant looking for somebody they already took into custody. And then you get George Floyd last Monday. And accentuating this, too, is Derek Chauvin, who is the former police officer who's been charged with second-degree murder. He has had 17 complaints in his jacket before this for excessive force, and he's only been a cop since 2001. So he's basically gotten one excessive force complaint per year since he became a police officer in Minneapolis. And the trend is what's damning, right? That this guy, and you can see it on his face, and you can see it on his face in his, even his,
mugshot.
Thank you. Yes. His mugshot. There is no regret. He does not think he did anything wrong. And I think he feels protected. And BuzzFeed had a picture of a Trump rally in Minneapolis last fall where the head of the Minneapolis Police Union was there wearing Trump or Cops for Trump t-shirts, which they sell on the Minneapolis Police Union's website.
Put union in quotes, but yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
This is my own personal beef. Yes.
Taken down.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's clearly a culture here of police being protected. And I do want to get to the broader picture, too.
Yep.
There was a study, I think it was in The Guardian, that said that showed like what 2019 looked like. There were 33 days in 2019 where there were no police shootings. 33 days out of a 365-day year where there were no police shootings. And there have been over 1,000 police killings. They're not just shooting, killings. The police have killed, in the United States, 1,000 people a year, over 1,000 people a year, in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019. So for 7 years, the police in the United States collectively have killed over 1,000 people for the last 7 years.
And we can...
Yeah.
Not knowing the exact nature of the study, the numbers, we can assume that the majority of the people on that list are black or of minority... Or mental health issues, the standard three things that probably top that list.
I don't know like what the circumstances for all those killings, obviously, but there was another chart. Yeah, there was another chart that said for black men in the United States, they have a lifetime risk of being shot by police that is almost 100%. A lifetime risk. Like it's more likely as a black man in the United States, you're going to get shot by the police than it is if you are white, if you're Latinx, or even if you're indigenous. And the most galling thing of all is that 99% of killings by police did not result in charges. A few are charged, even less are convicted, but 99% don't even result in charges.
And I believe that extends to police brutality as well. We'll call it the people that survive. And right. I guess the ultimate example of that would be Rodney King, because the difference between George Floyd and Rodney King was that Rodney King survived. And that was when it wasn't early on in video, but the fact that that was filmed, now we're at the point where virtually everything is documented, right? Mm-hmm. So there could the difference would have been if this George Floyd's murder had taken place 30 years ago in the Rodney King era, it'd be like, well, maybe, maybe not. And there would be this gray area because there was no clear evidence. It is clear as day on that video that, you know, what happened, to the countdown of the amount of time that the officer's knee was on George Floyd's neck. But and of course, I mentioned Rodney King, but of course this extends beyond, as you had listed, those incidents you were talking about had just happened in the past month or two, right? Goes back to Sandra Bland, dies in police custody, not as a direct result of police necessarily, but they still, it's unclear, right? Trayvon Martin is another example, going all the way back to, you know, even the famous, more famous people who were killed, like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Emmett Till, who was a boy who was killed and became, that was in the 50s, right? So we can go back through time, through the history of America, and find all of these, and that is a common thing when they speak to protesters. It's like, well, it's not, you know, nothing's different now. It was Black Lives Matter years ago, it was civil rights marches in the 60s. You go back and back and back in time. Something, it feels at least right now that something different is happening. And I wonder if this is what are we going to see change from this point on, right? Is something actually going to change? Those officers have been charged, but are we going to see systemic change? Or is it going to be coronavirus will once again overwhelm everything? We'll just sort of go back to the status of the way things were, and no concrete change will be in the pipe. I hope not, of course. I hope that isn't right. What's going to happen. But it's not as if we haven't seen the outpouring before. And it's also gone a bit global, too, as I saw the, you know, London, marches in London, Athens, South Africa, in Kitchener-Waterloo yesterday. Yeah. We'll get to the Canadian aspect, I guess, after the break. But yeah, this is the great question. In a few months, it may be the post-Trump era. Will things be different? Are people going to keep the pressure on? I feel there's this unknown as to whether, okay, we've had this outpouring and people want to see change. Marches in 100 cities, and something like, was it 10,000? No, yeah, 10,000 people have been arrested across the U.S. just in regards to this, and I guess varying degrees of charges. Some people are obviously arrested and just let go right away to get them off the street. And I guess we should mention it before we're almost out of time here. The targeting of journalists has been phenomenal. Everything from the CNN crew getting arrested to, let's say, community journalists, journalists of varying degrees, shot in the eye, Chilean style, gassed, flashbang grenades. It's like they, lots of places the police do not want the media. Anybody with a camera is targeted. That one getting the pepper ball shot directly at her.
Yeah.
Or rubber bullets aren't just being reserved for the protesters themselves. They are targeting the media. They're well back and they're saying, "We're the media. We're going to shoot you anyway."
I think that's been the most galling thing of all this. And I wouldn't even just, I mean, yeah, the attacks on the media, especially, there's a Vice reporter who was lying on the ground and the police were just walking by and sprayed them with pepper spray. And, you know, this is someone who's lying on the ground with their arms out peacefully as instructed by the police. And the police just wanders over and we'll spray you in the eye with pepper spray.
Let's give you a little blast. Yeah.
That's not fun. It's, you know. The thing is, and I saw somebody on Twitter say this, so I won't take it as my own, but somebody said, like, camera phones are the body cameras because everyone has them. Everyone's taking video. And the amazing thing is that the police feel so free to be abusive, to use excessive force, despite the fact they know everyone has a camera pointed at them. That has been incredible. That has been ultimately, like, maybe one of the most chilling aspects of all this is that despite the fact there is a camera everywhere pointed at everything, the police have been more brutal than I would have ever thought possible. Again, not all police, because certainly there have been some great examples of community policing and all this, but it's not a few bad apples. There is a definite culture of brutality in a lot of these police forces.
Yeah, and that's a lot. Once they are, I wouldn't say empowered, but where you get that kind of Legoland man outfit on, there's this sort of hint of invincibility, and you see it. They just pound people. There's been, as you sort of mentioned, there are some police that are trying to make a bit of peace with the protesters. There was the National Guard's people putting down their shields by request of the protesters. But then there's been other ones that were a ruse where the police or whoever the heck, the National Guard, whoever the heck it is, going down on their knee, drawing protesters in and then shooting at them. So I personally, in that kind of situation, wouldn't trust police. I had a slight taste of it at the G20. That was sort of my slight taste of a large action like that where there is a what they would call a fluid situation. And it's like, it is unlike anything. And I'm not trying to compare what I've been through on that one single day, trying to cover it as a journalist as to what has gone on in the U.S. or anything. But just to get a hint of that and that atmosphere, it is unlike anything else. And it's supposed to be all about control. It is not control. There's this feeling or sensation that at any given moment, it could spiral way out of control. And that out of control generally involves the police beating on people and kettling them and pepper spraying them and bombing them. So when they say, "Oh, this protest turned violent," it's usually, you know, when it's the one-on-one like that and it's the people with weapons, it's usually the weaponized that are causing the violence, in my opinion. That's not right.
Yeah. In these situations, too, what we see is that the response isn't to send out police. It's to send out police in riot gear. They are anticipating a riot before it happens. And I was listening to an interview with this one academic who was saying, like, they've been calling these a riot. But by the textbook definition of what a riot is, these aren't a riot, because riots start in peace. And for a lot of people of color in the United States, and maybe this can be a segue, in Canada too, they do not live in peace. So you can hardly call this a riot. And you can hardly call it a riot either when the first response of the police department, when you have a large gathering of angry people, is to send out riot cops with tear gas and shields.
Like I had said off the top, riot, rebellion, or revolution. But anyway, we'll leave that there. I'm sure we'll come back to it very soon, perhaps as soon as next week anyway. You're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're going to take a bit of a break now and possibly play a little bit of music, and we will return momentarily. That was a bit of the unmistakable voice of Aretha Franklin. She's 14 years old, and that recording was made Queen of Gospel, and that was Precious Lord. If I understand it right, George Floyd was a religious man, and I would have, beyond the shadow of a doubt, he would have been a fan of Sister Aretha. So that is from a vinyl vault. So, yes. So to Canada now, Adam. Along the same topic that we were talking about before the break, in terms of there seems to be a lot. Just before news time, I saw something about this. I don't want to get too much into the senators breaking with their charity or something, but it sounds messed up. People kind of shooting off and then having to not only backtrack, but lose some plum appointments, like Stockwell Day, who made a really, really idiot comment about racism, comparing his getting teased for wearing glasses to just deep-rooted racism in Canada. It's like, what are you talking about, man? Really, really, really. So, oh, and again, sorry, I just want to say as well, in addition to this, I had said to in terms of black commentary, as I'd mentioned earlier, Desmond Cole, friend of the show. Some other people to probably check out would be the great Robin Maynard, Andre Domies, and who else? Sandy Hudson, of course. Sandy Hudson of the Sandy and Nora podcast. Excellent this week, again on this topic, sandyandnora.com. Sandy Hudson's very interesting in that she has gone to law school in Los Angeles, so she is sort of straddling both sides of the divide right now, and has come out saying that police should just be defunded completely. And I wasn't quite as outright as that on her podcast, saying that because of what has gone on in Toronto, namely the death of Regis Kurchinski Paquette, that we should probably have an alternative force that isn't the police to go into situations when mental health is a concern in particular.
Yeah, I find this interesting. This discussion interesting because you don't send police to a fire, right? You don't send fire to a medical emergency.
They do in Guelph, but that's
They do in Guelph, but not everywhere.
No, it's the closest office response, right? But anyway, yeah. No, right. I get what you mean.
The point is though that things change. People used to get taught in a one-room schoolhouse with kids at all ages. Now we all go to school with kids our own age and through each grade.
On Zoom, but yeah.
Yeah.
Things do change, you're right, yeah.
Things evolve to suit the circumstances. And police will tell you, and the police have told us on our show even, that they're dealing with a lot more mental health calls. They're dealing with domestic disturbances. They're not just responding to a situation that might turn violent with a perpetrator that might have a weapon. And the police force maybe should be a little more flexible in terms of how it responds, or to have different types of responses. Perhaps have cops, maybe not call them police, but have a first response unit that deals with mental health concerns, and that is their responsibility. And maybe they are not armed. Maybe they are people with experience and training and education in psychiatric and therapeutic fields. You are not going to find that with your average police officer. It's not outside the realm of possibility that a police officer could have a psychiatric degree, but it's not a job requirement. So, there are a lot of big conversations that do need to be had. And I think how we fund police and the types of situations we expect police to respond to now is probably part of that conversation.
And this is my time weird, but I was thinking of Muhammad Ali, who very famously, and at the peak of his fame, found out that somebody, a black person in the States, was going to jump off of a building, and he stopped his car, went up and spoke to them and talked them out of it. I don't know what the end result of that was, but on that day, that person did not jump. Mm-hmm. So of course we, and, sticking to political for a second, Doug Ford backtracked on his comments too. They were similar to those of Stockwell Day, and in that Doug Ford initially had said Canada doesn't have the systemic deep roots of racism that the U.S. does, and then immediately backtracked in Queen's Park because I'm fairly sure somebody behind the scenes said, Doug, you really, you know, you probably should change that up because that's not exactly accurate.
It's night and day.
What's that?
It's night and day.
Oh, it's night and day. My headset blew off a little bit there. Is it that? Yeah, it's clear. Yeah. But yeah, the long story short is like any place built on colonial structure like Canada as well is built on racist principles, and as to how deep they are, structurally it is deep. And we've seen solidarity marches with what's going on in the U.S. both in the Kitchener-Waterloo one was, I saw a bit on CKCO yesterday, massive, absolutely massive. Nobody keeping the distances, everybody wearing masks. I guess the COVID-19 is sort of almost a subplot now to this. It's very Canadian, I think, that everybody had a mask on. I don't know about the distances, but you can completely understand why people want to get out on the streets. And Guelph is having, it's Saturday, right? Have I got that right?
Saturday at 2.
Saturday at 2. Guelph is having a similar march and discussion or speakers anyway.
Mm-hmm. If I can revisit Doug Ford for a minute, because sure. it goes a bit broader than him sort of being ignorant. Even for a white guy about systemic racism. One of the first things that Doug Ford and his government did when they came into office was cancel changes that was passed by the previous government to the way police are given oversight, changes to the SIU, the Special Investigations Unit. They repealed it. They took it out completely. And this falls very close into the conservative playbook of where the Law and Order Party and all that, understandable. And then Doug Ford, a few months after that, tries to replace the chief of the OPP with a family friend.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And this family friend was,
old for
lack of a better word, complicit in helping to, you know, keep on the DL some of the personal problems with Doug Ford's brother. Personal problems that probably would have resulted in Rob Ford getting thrown into the jail for life if he were black.
Exactly.
Drunk driving, drug use, domestic disturbance. So Doug Ford especially really needs to check his privilege, to borrow a phrase, on this, because no one has benefited more from white privilege, especially when it comes from policing, than the Ford family.
Yeah, and it's pretty rich when you like when somebody like Doug Ford he doesn't have much choice. He has to comment on what's going on. And similarly, I don't want to overplay it or talk about it too much about Justin Trudeau and his pause. It's not even the pause, it's the fact that I can't remember where it was. So of course somebody dug up the blackface picture. Like, it must be really weird to have to comment on that knowing that you were or are part of the problem, let's say, and that was top of mind for a very long time, still is, because, you know, blackface Justin is an image that's difficult to forget. but that his pause wasn't regarding that. It was sort of in his relation to the U.S., and he was really reluctant to just come out and say it. And I think Reverend Al Sharpton, I'm not sure if that was at the funeral today or before it, I did hear that, where he sort of made an indirect jab saying, you know, it doesn't take me 21 seconds to come up with something to say about Donald Trump. So that was a bit of a shot, actually, from Reverend Al.
I would point out that Reverend Al isn't the leader of a country.
But he is a leader of a community.
On the receiving end of one of Donald Trump's diatribes. Like, remember, we, you know, our steel and aluminum industry were slapped with tariffs because Trump thinks that we're ripping off the United States. All 35 million of us versus all 350 million of them. So.
Yeah, so we need to choose our words carefully. And normally the trick is to get a drink of water or, you know, pretend that, you know, you need to adjust something is usually what to do rather than just sort of blank like that. I'm sure he's exhausted. I mean, everybody's tired, right? But
what I find hilarious,
particular.
Though, is that in an era where we have Donald Trump in the United States, who will blather on for 5 minutes, regardless of his ignorance on a topic, we jump up and down on Trudeau for taking 20 seconds before saying something that could be construed as stupid or inadequate or something. And you know, I don't know what the 20 seconds were for. There is a staged sort of quality of that I'm going to stare at the camera for 20 seconds to make you understand the intensity of the situation. But would we rather have someone who just opens his mouth and lets his belly rumble, as my father once observed? I hardly think so. I see how well that's working in the United States. The alphabet soup that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth on any given topic.
Well, part of my lockdown reading was a book by Cecil Foster, who was a prof here. It was called "They Call Me George." It was about the Pullman Porter. So you heard about it, right? It was presented at the at Eden Mills last year. And I was thinking about sending it to Doug because I learned a lot from reading it. But in terms, it's not just about the train porters. It is about the story of systemic racism in Canada. Mm-hmm. And the basis of this country being wanting to be from almost day one, and prior to that, a white country. That was the goal of the founders of Canada. We have this illusion that it's like, well, it was always open and multicultural. Not true. Multiculturalism is a recent creation in this nation. And
I also want to say we have this illusion that our police do not target minorities in Canada. And there was a story that APTN ran looking at police brutality in Nunavut, of all places, where they have had 5 instances of police brutality in Nunavut this year, including 3 shootings involving Indigenous people.
And wasn't that incident with the – did you see it with the pickup truck, the RCMP? So what happened, for the people who haven't seen it, the RCMP drove up. There was a man presumably impaired. It looked like he was having some sort of difficulty. Drove up, and rather than just drive up and start talking to him, I opened the driver's side door of the truck and steamrolled him into a snowbank. And if I understand it right, that person, when in custody, was beaten up by their cellmate. I'm not sure where that is an evolving story, because I think that just happened within the past 48 hours. But
yeah, and it was
again,
also
what was the RCMP's job when they were created as the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, was to clear out Indigenous people for white settlers. True story, right? So from day one.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm going to send that, but I'm going to cross my name out because it was autographed, and send that to Doug, and probably end up on some kind of list with Antifa and other people, but we'll wait and see. And we didn't get to talk about Rex Murphy, but forget about Rex Murphy. We don't want to talk about Rex Murphy, but
I try to forget about Rex Murphy.
Yeah. He still keeps appearing, right? He surfaces like, that guy's still going? God, I thought they cut him off years ago. Oh, it sounds like the same people that used to call him are the ones calling Duncan McHugh on a Sunday now. Indignant white person checkup. I feel sorry for Duncan McHugh, actually, sometimes. So it should have just been him and Desmond Cole for a couple hours. But anyway, my own personal opinion, the views expressed on the show and all that. Anyway, the long-term care crisis and the COVID crisis continues, of course, in Ontario. We have the Ombuds Office has said that they were going to investigate the long-term care home situation. For those who don't know what the Ombudsman's Office, but I think Ombud is okay to say now, is an independent, nonpartisan arm of the legislature. And what they normally do is investigate a complaint from the public about something that is topical and of mind, a certain situation. I'm sure they probably received some complaints, but it sounded like that Paul Dubé, who is the ombudsman currently, in the wake of the report that the military put out about the long-term care homes, that he is going to issue a report on the situation. Although it may be difficult, because if I understand it right, what was I reading about the code red list will not be released. So the homes that are the most troublesome, or the lists of cases and what's going on in them, the government is really reluctant to release them. I guess it's kind of like the somebody's black book getting released and not wanting all that out there. But there seems to be some hesitancy on the government to say, well, we're not really going to talk about the red line ones. So,
well, it depends, because I mean, they were talking about Forest Heights was a long-term care home in Kitchener that St. Mary's Hospital in Kitchener is now running. They were, it was reported they were one of the red listed homes. And it maybe have to do with the way that the Region of Waterloo is reporting, because if you go to the Region of Waterloo public health page where they're reporting the COVID-19 numbers, they do have a breakdown of the outbreaks in their long-term care homes. And you can see right away, you go, you look at Forest Heights, where they have 244 cases of COVID-19, 175 in residents, 69 in staff, plus 51 deaths. They are, you know, far and away more, let's say, viral than the next most viral home, which was the Trinity Village long-term care home with 96 cases and 18 deaths. And their outbreak is technically over because it also lists, you know, where the outbreak is over. There are 9 long-term care homes in Waterloo region that are technically still in the midst of an outbreak. But just looking at the breakdown of the numbers in terms of cases and deaths, no question. You could probably find those lists at all the, like, the municipal websites in Ontario and probably compile that red line list just by comparing those numbers. But I mean, it is problematic.
For sure. I think with a certain amount of intuition, it could be done. And there are people, actually, I mentioned Nora of Sandy Nora earlier. She was compiling a list long before the Toronto Star and others were. It's one of those jobs that's a bit morbid, but there are people out there that, and I'm one of them, that feel it needs to be done because, as we know, it's like 80% of the fatalities so far of the... I'm not even sure what the 1600 residents have died, correct?
Yeah, 1600 of the COVID-19 deaths have been in long-term care
and
homes.
That's something in something like 80% of the total number of deaths from COVID-19 so far. Is that right? Yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So there used to be a patient ombudsman. I didn't realize that. And it happened to be Christine Elliott. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
She was appointed by the ghastly Kathleen Wynne. My goodness.
Well,
holy. I'm being facetious there, folks. I have no real opinion on Kathleen Wynne, but that's...
wasn't it Dalton McGuinty?
Was Kathleen Wynne the Minister of Health at that point? I think she might have been.
Yes, she might. Yeah, I think she was. But I think it was under... technically when Dalton McGuinty was premier, because there was a whole political scandal about them appointing Christine Elliott so they can open up Christine Elliott's seat so they can have a by-election and hopefully a Liberal would win so that they would technically have a majority. This was like around 2011, 2012.
Bit of horse trading going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, having said that, whoever's in that job temporarily, because you mentioned the ombudsman is investigating.
Well, I don't think there is anybody in that job right now. And that's the problem or the challenge.
Well, there's nobody permanent in the job right now. There is still a patient ombudsman office that is going to be looking at the patient care angle. The ombudsman, Paul Dubé, is going to be looking at sort of the broader picture. But I mean, there's like multiple investigations going on now. That includes the independent commission that is starting up, and that is still, they're still working out what that's going to look like. And
I think concurrent to this is like the Auditor General's report, right? Was announced in May. It's going to review a whole bunch of that's Bonnie Lysick, right?
Mm-hmm.
Emergency preparedness, planning, and long-term care will be rolled into that. So there's going to be a pile of reports soon, or maybe not soon. It will take a while because it is, as they keep saying, I'm so sick of the list is fluid, the situation is fluid, you know, fluid is the new whatever. it's always a fluid situation, right? But there was also, beyond the red-listed ones, there was something like 59 were yellow. I would say blue or yellow. It's kind of like a caution. And as you know, because you compiled the health department reports, is like there are a lot of people that won't go to a restaurant that's sort of on the questionable list, right? So that's a heck of a lot of places as well. 59 are kind of like, sure, but they did say they didn't want to release this list because they're like, well, that'll give them a bit of a tip off that we're looking at them. It's like, I think they all know that they're all being probably more heavily scrutinized now than they have been maybe ever. But part of that scrutiny getting dropped, a lot of that's to do with the conservative government laws that passed in the last fall. And we talked about that last show, so I don't really want to get into it too much. But it's one of those things, like, can you imagine? I was thinking about this. Could you imagine if this is maternity wards? Like, you gave that number 1,600. Could you imagine if the maternity wards in Toronto, babies were dying? Babies are just continuously dying. It's like, it would change tomorrow. It would change right now. They would call in the military. They would call in everybody, and it would stop. But this is like, well, you know, we got to look at it.
Well, on the agenda, they had on a man named Michael Hurley, who is with the Ontario Council of Hospital Unions.
And yeah, it's a division of QP.
Yeah, he was... They had done their own report about violence in long-term care homes last year, and he was on mostly to talk about that. But he also talked, and it struck me when he said this, is that, you know, after World War II, there was, of course, the baby boom. You had all these soldiers coming back home, left as boys, came back as men, so they needed their own homes. Home building went up very, very quickly. Then you have the baby boom happening. You have a lot of new kids, so you have a lot of new school construction going up really, really quickly. And you have to have this economy that adapts to more and more people who are coming into the workforce. And, you know, for 50 years, that was kind of how things adapted. You know, as the baby boomers came along, you had all this glut of people going through, you know, the continuum of life, let's say. Society would adapt. Now we're at the end of life for the baby boomers, right? And what we see is that society is not adapting the way it did before. They're getting pitiable care. It's Band-Aid solutions up and down. We never really stopped to take into account to how we were going to manage all these people when they got to the end of life, and we're kind of seeing the end result of that. And to go back to your point, yeah, if it was a maternity ward, there would be bloody blue murder. There'd be hell to pay. But because it's the end of life, we've been putting it off. And mostly because, I guess, probably of negative societal things about wanting to deal with, you know, death and stuff. But here we are.
And that's the thing. 50 years ago, corporations were paying way more tax. 50 years ago, we also had a massive manufacturing base. And yep. Globalization wasn't really a thing. And so the neoliberal approach to everything, which is privatizing anything that moves to a degree, didn't really exist then. But rather than get into that conversation, which is probably for another hour and another day, another time, I guess we have a little bit of time to wrap up on that, Adam. I got ahead of myself there. I was shutting her down. We have a couple minutes yet.
Off to the side of all these health concerns, as I went to the Board of Health meeting virtually, of course, yesterday. And one of the things they discussed is that Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph Public Health has spent about $1 million in responding to COVID-19. Now, there will be savings because they pretty much canceled all the rest of their regular programs and all their staff has been shunted to COVID-19 response. But they're covering overtime, they're covering additional staff, they're covering
tracing, all those things that they wouldn't normally be doing.
Yeah, like $250,000 of new supplies, having to buy PPE and rapidly and all that stuff. And of course, and this goes back to one of the other decisions that the Ford government wanted to make. They wanted to amalgamate a ton of public health units. Can you imagine the situation in public health right now if Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph Public Health had been amalgamated with Peel and Halton and Waterloo Region, and you're dealing with like 2 million people all in this, covered in this one health unit, and how that would look, and how much effort and how much it would disrupt, you know, what has turned out in many places to be actually a pretty orderly administration of a public health crisis, at least here in, you know, being covered by Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph Public Health. But I mean, that's something to be on the radar too, is what's going to happen to public health at the end of all this.
For sure. And I think the brakes have been put on those mergers and amalgamations for now anyway. Mm-hmm. But that is a topic definitely for another day. So... Once again, you've been listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, heard every Thursday from 5 to 6 with Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, where can the listeners find out more about yourself?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca and see some cool articles and stuff.
Excellent. And I'm Scotty Hertz. Where can you find me? Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook, and I blog occasionally at something called The Spanner Book, but I haven't lately because there's been so much going on. Anyway, we had too much time. Now we are completely out of time. Adam, thanks once again for joining me via the Skype. I guess that's a plug for Skype, but it's working out really well, so we'll give him a little bit of a plug. And tune in next week, folks, for more of Open Sources. We're glad to join you every week here on your campus community radio station, CFRU 93.3 FM. À la prochaine.